Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 156 for August 3rd, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
This has matured into a sort of almost voluptuous, sort of fruity, melon, peachy type characteristic, but on both of them, you know, when you drop down a level of taste and smell, you get that distinct Bowmore, very slight peatiness.
That's Andrew Rankin, Chief Blender and Operations Manager at Morrison Bowmore, and he's talking about the new White Bowmore. Actually, it's not new. It's very, very old. It's the fraternal twin to the classic Black Bowmores from 1964, and it's coming out next month. Details later, but first, let's look at the news. It's not often that the Macallan comes out with a new expression, but that's the case this week. The Macallan Estate Oak will be sold only at airport duty-free shops. It's a no-age statement malt that will have an appeal to environmentalists. That's because the distillery will plant an oak tree on the Macallan Estate in Speyside for every bottle that's sold. It's priced at around £35 a bottle, or about $70 U.S., Bruichladdich is coming out with a second edition of its 18-year-old Islay malt. The original was matured in American oak, then spent time in Austrian sweet wine casks. The new edition also spent 18 years in American oak, but this new one was then put in sweet wine casks from the Jurançon region in the French Pyrenees, and that gives it a slightly different taste from the first edition. It's priced at around £50, or about $100 a bottle. Ireland's Clontarf isn't out with a new whiskey, but does have a new website, complete with a photo contest aimed at exposing the new Irish. The winning photographer gets $5,000. There's a link for more details at the Whiskey Cast website. In the U.S., Heaven Hill is out with the 1998 edition of its Evan Williams Single Barrel Vintage Bourbon, and a company called Brave Spirits has released a series of spirits honoring the military, police, and firefighters. The whiskey in the series is called First In Whiskey. A portion of sales will go to charities that support the military and emergency workers. And a very special whiskey will go on sale this week at one location only, George Washington's distillery at the Mount Vernon Estate just outside Washington, D.C. This bourbon has been in the works since 2001, when 11 distillers donated barrels of bourbon to Mount Vernon for aging on the estate. Those barrels were blended 3 years ago and have just been bottled. 50-milliliter bottles will sell for $25 each with a special collector's glass. The proceeds go to help maintain the Mount Vernon estate. And this coming weekend, Mount Vernon will hold a special commemoration of the Whiskey Rebellion, which took place in 1794, when President George Washington sent federal troops into western Pennsylvania to enforce excise taxes on the local distillers. Now, you might wonder, why celebrate what was essentially a police action? But as I discussed with Mount Vernon historian Ken Johnston, it's a key part of American history that had some very good unintended side effects.
What we're going to show is what local reaction was to the event, because, of course, the actual event took place in western Pennsylvania around the modern-day Pittsburgh area and south of there at the Five Forks region. So, of course, the events out there are affecting the country as a whole, and this is really the first national test of national laws with a reaction against national laws. So what you've got is, by late August, early September, after President Washington has declared martial law, the states are sending the state militia to a rendezvous point in Pennsylvania where they're going to become federal troops. This is the first time this has ever happened. And so you have people arguing both for and against this. And so what we're going to try to represent with our scenes at the gristmill are what theoretically conversations could have been like. One of our characters is going to be Mr. Davenport, who was the actual miller here in 1794, and he's going to be engaged in conversation with a couple of young bucks who are off to join the militia. And so they're going to get into a debate, a very spirited debate, about who's right and who's wrong in this, because, of course, from a certain perspective, all that those guys out in western Pennsylvania are doing are protesting what they perceive to be unjust taxation without representation. And they're doing it in the exact same way it was done by the founding fathers and patriots, you know, 20 years before. So that's a very powerful argument. But then on the other hand, this is now a republic with a constitution, and there has to be a rule of law. You've got, and if you have disagreements with the law, there are legal channels to express your discontent. So it's both sides have very, very powerful arguments, and you know, we're going to see how it plays out.
And the cynic in me would point out that what we're celebrating here is the cracking down on is almost what would be described as the revenue is cracking down on the bootleggers almost.
Not really. The Whiskey Rebellion is, well, it's a lot more complex issue than
I know.
Term. Yeah, I know. Of course you do. Seriously, the guys out west didn't so much, what they were protesting was what they felt was unfair treatment and unfair taxes. I mean, that's what they said. If you look at the historical record, in a sense, it's true. Pennsylvania had one of the most democratic constitutions of any of the new states. Well, shortly before the whiskey excise was passed, early in 91, the conservatives had retrenched the Constitution and disenfranchised a lot of people. A lot of people who had the vote lost it. So there was really some feeling that, you know what, you took away our vote and then you passed a law that we couldn't vote against. So there's some grounds for their attitude. It's just that the immediate cause for it is, of course, the whiskey excise tax. And what's happening is people are feeling like the small distiller is having to register his still and pay rates that are equal to what large distillers are doing, who make far more money and can more easily afford it. There's not enough distinction made between large and small distillers. Well, guess where the large distillers are? In the eastern part of the country, you know, whereas those poor guys out west, like, you know, we're just simple folks. This isn't even the majority of our income. Why are you charging us like it is? That's really what it's about.
And to put all this in historical context, this is still about, I believe, 10 to 15 years before President Washington, became one of those large distillers himself.
Correct? It's actually only 5 years. The Whiskey Rebellion happens in 1794. Well, actually, Washington dies in 99, but he starts his distillery in 97. So it's really only 3 years later. And so, of course, and that's actually a question we get. People say, well, didn't Washington just put down those poor guys out in western Pennsylvania so he could start his own big distillery? And nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. I want to make sure we get this point out because we've talked about Washington being a distiller, and we want to make sure we get there. There's no conflict of interest here because
as a matter of fact,
business himself at the time.
Right, and as a matter of fact, that's one of the main points we bring out at our program, because there are two scenes. The first scene takes place in 94 with the debate I was talking to you about. The second scene takes place in 1799, and it's James Anderson, Washington's Scottish farm manager, talking about how Washington came to be in the whiskey business, and it's because of James Anderson. The whiskey business, the distillery, wasn't even Washington's idea. It was his Scottish farm manager's idea, who started working for him well after the rebellion. So that is a very good point. We make sure that you realize, you know, that Washington wasn't just putting down competition, so to speak. He wasn't even in the whiskey business, had no idea he ever would be.
And there's another side effect of this, if I remember correctly, that we ought to bring out, is that a bunch of these little guys in Pennsylvania that wound up losing on the end of the Whiskey Rebellion, if I remember correctly, a bunch of those guys moved down to Kentucky and
They certainly did. That is exactly the point. That's what's so interesting about this. You know, Washington federalizes the militias. He marches west. And, of course, the rebellion has already collapsed before the army even gets there because they realize, you know, this is ridiculous. There's no way we can fight the federal government. But what they do is, as you pointed out, many of them simply go further west. They head into Kentucky. They head into Tennessee. And even though, you know, the rebellion has collapsed, the federal government still collects maybe 5 to 10% of the taxes that they thought they were going to collect. I mean, they still can't collect the tax. People just simply hide their stills or move west. So Mr. Alexander Hamilton's pet project, and that's, you know, whose project this was, winds up costing like on the order of 10 to 20 times more in expended revenue to enforce than it ever actually brought in.
Another example of bureaucracy running amok.
Exactly.
But this is another example of why we pay attention to history classes in school, because the whole Whiskey Rebellion is what essentially created the bourbon industry that we know today.
Well, exactly. I think that's a very plausible argument that this really got those really, you might say, the best of those local distillers to move into country that was ideally suited for what they were doing. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better environment than Kentucky, Northern Tennessee to set up distilleries. So exactly, the Whiskey Rebellion sort of pushed out the people to a better place.
So all the unintended consequences just seem to sort of come together here and work really well.
And that's the fun part about history. You see how these stories, they're great stories. You know, people start doing one thing and they wind up saying, hey, you know what? This isn't what I thought was going to happen, but this turned out okay, you know, depending on your point of view.
The Whiskey Rebellion events are August 9th and 10th, and if you'd like to find out more about George Washington's distillery, check the archives for episode 108 from last September. By the way, the whiskey that's been distilled over the last couple of years is still aging. No word on when it might be available to the public. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Whiskey Fringe is this coming weekend in Edinburgh, Scotland. This week is also Peat Week at the Brandy Library in New York, with several special tastings on the schedule. The Dundee Dell in Omaha, Nebraska will hold a Highland Park tasting with Martin Duraz on the 14th. Tickets are still available for the Whiskey on the Hudson cruise September 10th in New York City. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 16th through the 21st in Bardstown. Tickets are still available for the Astor Center's Whiskey Blending Class with John Glazer of Compass Box on September 18th in New York City. And Whiskey Life Paris is the weekend of September 20th and 21st. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. And it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at Laphroaig.com. Back in episode 131 last February, we heard about one of the world's iconic whiskies, the new edition of the Black Bowmore, and there was a hint back then of something to come. That something is the White Bowmore, the fraternal twin to the Black, even rarer and even more expensive. Only 732 bottles are available worldwide, 40 for the U.S., at a price of about $6,000 each. I tasted the White Bowmore this week with Morrison Bowmore Chief Blender and Operations Manager, Andrew Rankin.
The difference between the two is Black Bowmore spent its life in walnut brown sherry casks. The White Bowmore has spent its entire life in ex-bourbon barrels. So characteristics of maturation between the two casks are completely different. The Black Bowmore, if you remember, was a very sort of gutsy, sherry, raisiny product, very dark in colour, hence the Black Bowmore. The White Bowmore is a much more subtle whiskey, now given by the American white oak, and this has matured into a sort of almost voluptuous, sort of fruity, melon, peachy type characteristic. But on both of them, when you drop down a level of taste and smell, you get that distinct Bowmore, very slight peatiness.
And both of these were produced at the time that some very distinct changes were taking place at the Bowmore Distillery, correct?
Yeah, it was one of the early distillations in 1964 when the Morrison family took over the distillery from the previous owners. I have to say, now, The Morrison family would claim that they had great foresight to lay such wonderful whiskies down for 42 and 43 years later. The reality is that in those days that it was impossible to plan so far ahead, and it's just our good fortune that we have such wonderful whiskies still in inventory. We're owned by Suntory of Japan, and we don't have financial pressures forced upon us to sell the inventory as quickly as we can. They're a company that they're in the business for the long term. They recognise the value and support us in maintaining aged stocks that we can release to the public over many years, and indeed we're laying down stocks not for our generation but for the next generation ahead. So hopefully, you know, the legacy of Beaumont will continue way into the future.
Taking back to that time in 1964 when the changes were taking place after the Morrison family had come in, I know there were some renovations done to the distillery. There were changes being made at the time that in essence may have changed the spirit somewhat from what was being produced, if I remember correctly, but that made things really special at the time that that first spirit came off the stills in 1964.
Yeah, man, like any distillery in Scotland, they've evolved through the years. Exactly what happened, I don't know, because I was still young. The changes of the distillery, you know, when we look back in old photographs, are quite expansive. The spirit itself, I think it's fair to say, in all distilleries, you know, where you have different sort of different stills, you're expanding, you're moving, you've got different heating sources, there obviously would be some subtle differences in the spirit, but in the main, we have never changed Beaumont new spirit dramatically, and it's always maintained the same peating levels. We keep it as close to we can in terms of continuity of production, and I think that comes out clearly when you look at our new releases. Beaumont is very distinct. It's not the most peated on the island, but everything we release is definitively Beaumont.
And this is even more rare than the black Beaumont now, correct?
This one only has about 730 bottles, so the rarity value is there. And we will be releasing another one, which we're keeping under wraps next year, from the same stable, and it will be even less. But we'll whet your appetite and keep that one close to our chest.
Tell me about your history in the business. How did you get started?
I started in 1974 with Seagram in Paisley, and the company was Shivers Brothers. And I started in the blending laboratory, quality control, progressed through the blending, working under a superb chief blender at the time, a chap called James Lang. And credit to him, he taught me most of what I know in blending. I then went on to work in the stock management side of the business, and indeed covered most of the disciplines throughout production, distilling, maturation, blending, vatting. But always to my heart was the quality side of it, and I've retained that passion throughout the 34 years I've been in the business. My particular passion is the cask management side of it. You alluded earlier on, Jack, to, you know, the quality of the spirit. You can get away with slight changes to the quality of new spirit. It's the influence of the cask, I believe, you know, give you the biggest difference on your final product. And it's important to, as an MBD, that we maintain a very high product profile on cask management. And indeed, I think, and I like to think, on a litre produced basis, we have the highest investment on a litre to pound basis than any other company in the industry.
How hard is it to find good casks these days? Because I know a lot of distillers are having trouble sourcing good wood for casks because of the demand.
Yeah, we've been fortunate over the 17 years I've been involved in Morrison Beaumont that we use the same suppliers today that we used 17 years ago. So in the good times and the bad times with high and low production, we've always maintained a minimum volume. Some of the companies have come in, they've dropped out, so the loyalty is not there between supplier and customer. So we have a couple of bourbon suppliers who have been very loyal to us. We are only a single malt company now, so our volumes don't rise dramatically like some of the big blending companies. So we have got a good steady supply, we know the quality, they know us, and you know, we're happy with that.
Interesting question here that doesn't get asked very often. Is there a difference between the barrels that you pick that Beaumont whiskey goes into compared to what you might put Auchentoshan or Glengarry malts into?
No, we source a bourbon from two suppliers. We source a sherry from one supplier, so we have a very firm wood policy on all our single malts, so it's exactly the same quality of barrel that goes into a Beaumont, that goes into an Auchentoshan, that goes into Glengarry, and indeed the other malt that we have, which is a geographical one, which is McLellan's.
So there's no difference, for instance, you might take a look at specific barrels and say, let's send this one to Beaumont just because of the characteristics of the wood, compared to sending a different piece of wood or a different style of wood to Auchentoshan or McLellan's or Glengarry?
No. Our sherry casks are all European oak. They're all seasoned exactly the same way. The only difference we would get is just the generic difference in wood, and that only comes through once you start the maturation process.
What do you guys think about all the finishes that are coming out? Because I know you're starting to experiment a little more and more at Morrison Beaumont with wine finishes.
We've always stuck to the three principal supplies, which is wine barrels. Our parent company own a chateau in Saint-Julien. We've had a guarantee supply, believe it or not, for the last 12 years. So I'd like to think we're not new into it. It just takes a long time for quality to come through. Our sherry casks, they're in the supply chain. The bourbon casks, we'll be talked about that.
And you're releasing a Beaumont wine finish too, right?
We're releasing a Beaumont wine matured, 1992, and that spent 6 years of its life in bourbon and 10 years in wine. So whilst it's new to the market, the concept of maturing in wine is 10-12 years old. We haven't as a company gone down the route of trying different types of wines, white wines, red wines, sweet wines, dry wines. I firmly believe that stick to the basics that the industry have always been supplied with, and that, as far as I'm concerned, is wine, sherry and bourbon.
And the interesting note here is that you're maturing these for 10 years in wine, while other distilleries, which will go unnamed, may do 6 months to a year to 2 years in a wine barrel and call it a wine enhancement or a wine finish. But in your case, a majority of the wine, of the whiskey's maturation is taking place in these wine barrels.
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment in other companies on why they determine their policy. That's probably marketing driven, but we are fortunate that our marketing people do listen to us, and we do set the standards on what we are prepared to release to the market. We have had wine finish before, the Beaumont Claret was and is now quite iconic, but that was a minimum of 2 years and ended up nearer 3 to 4 years. And I believe that before you can get any influence from the cask whatsoever, it has to be a minimum of 2 years, otherwise it's almost just dipping your feet in the water. I'm not saying I'm right and I'm not saying I'm wrong, but that's a principle we apply in quality. This particular one is one that we laid it down sort of many, many years ago, not with the intention of releasing it as a special. And that's the beauty of special editions, that you can't plan 16 years ago what you're going to do today. So our job is to constantly analyse the stocks we've got and then come up with concepts that fit marketing plans, trends in the industry, and that's why we're choosing to release the 1992 just now.
By the way, the 1992 Bowmore is already available in many markets worldwide and should be hitting the U.S. this fall. It's bottled at 53.5% ABV, and if you like Bordeaux wine, you'll love this one. I scored it in 89. Oh yeah, back to the white Bowmore. Like the black, it's simply one of the best whiskies I have ever tasted. This one, it's full of mangoes, pineapples, and other tropical fruits, while still keeping a nice balance with the wood and some subtle vanilla notes. Earlier this year, I scored the Black Bowmore a 97. This one gets a 96. It's the perfect scotch for a hot summer day. Two other Bowmore notes. There's a new expression coming. The Maltman's selection will be available later in August, only at the distillery and through the Bowmore website. And Ian McCallum, the Bowmore senior blender who led us through the Black Bowmore tasting in episode 131, has now been named distillery manager at Auchentoshan. More on that with Ian in the next episode. Finally, a clarification from the last episode. In the discussion of the Amrut single malt whiskies from India, I said that the water source was fed by snowmelt from the Himalayas. While the barley is grown in that region and is grown with water from snowmelt from the Himalayas, it is not the distillery's water source. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. You'll find links, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening. Thank you.